commentator. Now, I had no idea what that meant, and I had to immediately learn everything I possibly could in order to not let everyone down. And then I think I probably annoyed a lot of the kind of the more meathead fans, you know, who just wanted stats, stats, stats. But we stuck with it, and it's become this sort of charming. It's my best gig of the year, I think.
Oh, that's so good to hear. Well, just finally then, Danny, without spoilers, very important, just mark our cards. Is there anything we can especially look forward to in the 2025-26 competition?
There's some lovely supportive moments. There are some extremely, there's a couple of moments that spring to mind. A very unusual way to psych himself up. One competitor decided to attack the equipment before he even began, using his forehead. And that's not bright. That's not a great thing to do. I mean, he was following his heart, but by doing so created quite a bloody scene before he'd even begun. So, I don't think he'll be doing that again.
Right. Oh, well, that's one to watch out for. Well, look, I will try not to do that to the television, and I hope listeners won't do that, but I can't wait to watch it. And, well, thanks so much for giving us the commentator's eye on literally the biggest sporting event this Christmas.
Not at all. Thank you.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Good afternoon, it's 2 o'clock. I'm John Harvey, and you're listening to Times Radio. Still to come on the programme this afternoon, Vassos Alexander will join us to assess the best of the festive season sport this year. Also, why a rage room might be the perfect Christmas gift. And money man Adam Shaw will bring us some good news on mortgages. But first, the news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. Wes Streeting has openly defied Sir Keir Starmer by backing a UK return to a customs union with the EU, despite the Prime Minister ruling it out. It comes as polling suggests strong support for the move among Labour voters, fueling speculation about the Health Secretary's wider ambitions. David Hennig is director of the UK Trade Policy Project at the European Centre for International Political Economy. Speaking to Times Radio, he warned there'd be no immediate positive impact from joining a customs union.
The level of uncertainty would still be there because so many people in UK politics are still saying we don't want this. I think it would have to be quite a significant commitment to start turning around the economic picture. It has to be relatively settled for businesses to want to invest. And clearly, simply just saying we will rejoin a customs union, even were that to be attainable, which I don't actually think it is, would not in the short run change the UK's economy.
Puppy farms, trail hunting and snare traps are all to be banned under animal welfare reforms being introduced by the government. Ministers have unveiled the animal welfare strategy, which also takes aim at other measures seen as cruel, such as shock collars as well as cages and crates for farm animals. Rural campaigners have called the proposals another attack on the countryside and accused Labour of acting like authoritarian control freaks. Simon Hart is the chief executive of the Countryside Alliance.
These sort of things, you're banning trail hunting, whatever that means, however you do that, you're banning an activity which doesn't actually involve live animals anyway. Is this going to make any real difference to anything other than to anger and frustrate rural people?
A senior Russian general has been killed in a car bomb attack in Moscow, with investigators examining potential Ukrainian involvement. Lieutenant General Fanel Sarovov died after an explosive device detonated beneath his vehicle. The Sunday Times' Europe editor, Peter Conradi, says the killing marks a significant escalation, striking at the heart of Russia's military establishment.
They have done it in the past. We've had at least, I think, three or four other instances. To some extent, the Ukrainians do their own thing. You know, what is the point of this? I mean, this guy was the head of the operational training directorate of the general staff. So, you know, he was directly involved in the war, one could say. One could call him a legitimate military target.
A suspected sinkhole drained a canal and swallowed narrowboats in Shropshire. Authorities have declared a major incident. Matt Steele has more.
It was the early hours of this morning that emergency services received reports of a collapsed bank in Whitchurch. Drone footage shows a huge hole in the embankment with a large area of land beside it flooded. At least four boats are stranded, including two which appear to have fallen into a 50-metre hole in the canal bed. 10 people have been helped to safety.
And motorists could be paying over the odds at the pump. The competition watchdog says fuel retailers' profit margins remain persistently high and unexplained, even though petrol prices have fallen over the past year. The CMA warns weak competition means prices aren't dropping as much as they should. A new government fuel finder tool next year is designed to help compare real-time prices. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
It's 4 minutes past two, and this is John Harvey on Times Radio. And I'm with you till 4pm with another 2 hours of the very best news, features, culture and comment. Starting us off for this hour is the wonderful sound of Jackie Wilson there with Riet Petit, which weirdly, as you might remember, was Christmas number one back in 1986. And coming up in the next hour, we'll take a look at some of the UK's most conspicuous and notorious festive hits. Also, between now and three, I'll be discovering what is a rage room and could it be an unlikely last-minute gift option for a loved one. We'll ask whether improvements in UK farming standards can avoid leading to an increase in lower standard imported food. And Vassos Alexander will be joining me to mark our cards for all the very best in this year's festive sport. Then later in the show, I'll be speaking to, well, at least one of the stars of Impression show Dead Ringers, where the mere mention of Keir Starmer led to a chorus of boos. And film and music journalist Clara Amfro will give us her tips on what to watch this holiday season and why there's a special magic about going to a cinema to do it. And here's an extra personal sprig of holly for today's show, because while I'm spending the afternoon with you on the wireless, my wife Sarah is very heavily pregnant with our second child, who may or may not be a Christmas Day baby. Have you got any Christmas birthdays or stories in your life, or any tips for how to navigate the festive season with a newborn? Do tell me, I am all ears. You can get in touch in any of the usual ways, WhatsApp on 0333 003 2353. You can text us on 87222, start your message with the word Times, or you can email us studio@times.radio. Now, ministers have laid out their animal welfare strategy plans, which includes a ban on certain cages for chickens and pigs. Farmers say the move could be yet another blow to British farming if it's not matched by higher welfare standards for imported meat, as it means British farmers could be undercut by EU countries where such cages remained legal. Phil Clark is a news editor and poultry journalist for Farmers Weekly, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show, Phil.
Hello there. Hi.
So first of all, can you tell us what cages we're talking about here, what animals are involved and what it does to them in the farming industry?
Okay, well, there's kind of two elements to this, the laying hen side of things and the pig production side of things. So on laying hens, we used to have what were called barren battery cages, which were banned in the UK in 2012. And since then, the whole industry has moved over to what are called enriched cages. So those are colony systems where birds, rather than being housed individually, are kept in groups of sort of 40 to 60 birds in obviously a much, much larger cage. And they have various bits and pieces in there, like nesting areas, scratching areas, perching areas, basically to fulfill more of their natural needs. When I say the whole industry, I'd also point out that the caged sector, which produces the budget egg, is only about 15% of the whole egg industry. So the vast majority in the UK is free range.
So, So let me just come in on that, because you mentioned the cages that did used to exist and the ones that are existing now. But are the ones, like, for example, for pigs now, things like dangers, for example, sows crushing their piglets, is that part of the issue? Is it a proper welfare concern for the animals themselves?
Very much so. I mean, on the pig side of it, we're talking about what are called farrowing crates. And basically they are systems where the pregnant sow will give birth to her piglets, maybe 12, 15, whatever number are born. And for the first 4 weeks in that system, and again, it's a minority system overall, it does provide room for the piglets to get out of the way, basically, because the mother pig is inclined to roll over, move around, and you get mortality from piglets being crushed. So the farrowing crate is there for a short period of time until the pigs are weaned to provide them with protection from the sow. Even in sort of more free-range systems, you'll get that incidence of piglet mortality from sows crushing their piglets.
Well, let me ask you about how the political side of this could play out, because I'm sure listeners would be delighted to hear that we want to have higher welfare standards for meat in this country. But equally, if it's just going to be simply be undercut by imported meat, which don't have those standards, then it's kind of a self-defeating issue. Is it as simple as the government simply maintaining or imposing the same welfare standards for imported meat as for British farmers? And is that difficult to achieve? This doesn't seem like it should be that complex.
Well, certainly it would help, but the experience with the in the pig sector was that in 1999, I think it was, we unilaterally banned sow stalls and tethers where the cows the pigs were actually tethered. The rest of Europe didn't move that way until 2013, I think it was. And in that time, we went from 80% self-sufficiency to 45% self-sufficiency. So we have a experience in the pig sector of the industry being damaged by unilateral action. And the fear is that this will, could easily happen again. I think certainly the trade deals that have been done since Brexit, we've seen that with Australian cattle production, New Zealand production, the various trade deals have been done, that our production standards haven't been protected as they said they would be.
Well, just briefly then, you mentioned trade deals, of course, that we hear so much about those these days. Just in a word, would you say then, therefore, at the moment, the biggest pressure on the industry is how our government acts, or pressures from abroad and how trade deals are being struck?
Well, it's incredibly important that trade deals are struck in the right way, and changing sector slightly. We had the US trade deal done not so long ago, and as part of that, we gave the US access to our bioethanol market. We have two bioethanol plants in this country. Well, now we've only got one, and the one remains is closing as well. We've more or less lost that market for farmers in a different sector, but that's how things can go.
And do you feel the government is letting you down as a sector, or is it too early to tell with a Labour government sort of 18 months in?
Well, there's a whole host of other areas to get into there, but obviously the inheritance tax is one that has been very high profile in the last year. But there is a very strong feeling from labour availability, labour costs, through to taxation treatment, through to provision of replacement support schemes, which exist elsewhere in Europe, still exist in parts of the UK, but have been more or less removed in England. There's a lot of disenchantment with the way things have gone in the last 18 months.
Well, I think listeners will all know that that the farming community is an area of weakness for the government and indeed the Prime Minister. So thank you so much for laying out your analysis of the industry as it stands and these potential new welfare standards. That's Phil Clark, poultry journalist for Farmers Weekly. Coming up, Rage Against the Room. I'll be explaining all soon. You're listening to John Harvey on Times Radio. It's 13 minutes past two.
Global events.
There's a warning that the impact of climate change is getting more severe and we're not prepared.
Breaking news.
Following allegations of potential fraud raised by The Times.
Reactive analysis.
What's going on in the government about discussion of extremism?
From the world's best journalists.
We're trying to look at some of the questions about migration and the implications for the economy, jobs and public services.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
This Christmas, McDonald's and the Elf on the Shelf are bringing festive tasks to your little ones, like writing a Christmas card for your postie.
Thank you. You're one happy helper.
Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 30th of December, from 11 a.m, includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last, subject to availability, fair ordering policy applies.
My granddad says, the best Christmas gift isn't always something you can unwrap, like an investment with Aberdeen Investment Trust. I might not get excited about it now, but he says one day I might just realise how thoughtful it was. Something to help build my future. He says Aberdeen offer lots of investment opportunities and he hopes I'll thank him when I grow up. Search Aberdeen Investment Trust to find out more. When investing, please remember that your capital's at risk.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
This is Times Radio.
It's just coming up to 2:15, and this is John Harvey. Now, what boils your blood this time of year? Is it queues in the supermarket, delayed or cancelled trains, Mariah Carey everywhere you go? Well, would you consider booking yourself into a rage room to take it all out on some bags of crockery and a sewing machine? When The Times' Jesse Hewitson's 10-year-old son had an experience that left him feeling really angry, she took him to a rage room in the hopes of providing him with a healthy outlet. I caught up with Jesse and started by asking her what a rage room is.
Yeah, so a rage room is basically a room where you can... you're given permission to smash household objects to smithereens. So it could be sewing machines, it could be crockery, it could be dishwashers, it can be computers. So basically the rage room itself is empty except for a table. And on the wall is your like array of weapons that you can choose, whether they're baseball bats, they could be crowbars. And you put the objects put on the table and you just go crazy and reduce it to, yeah, to ash.
Right. And you didn't go to this on your own, did you? It was a family affair, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So an event had taken place that had left my 10-year-old angry, and I was trying to work out how to help him sort of deal with this anger. And so I struck on this idea of taking him to a rage room, but I was, and to some extent am, very unsure whether it was this kind of stroke of parenting brilliance or whether it was a really, you know, terrible mistake. So we did, yeah, we went, and, you know, I must admit, when I was sort of raging, I initially found it a bit sort of awkward. I felt almost self-conscious, but I did notice that my 10-year-old had no such problems at all. He sort of slipped into rage pretty easily.
Yes, well, that's the inhibitions of adulthood, I suppose. Yeah. But interestingly, you've already used those two separate words there, rage and also anger. And is it true from your writing and your experience of this that those are separate things that maybe sometimes we sort of elide and think of together, but they are different, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. So I interviewed a man called Mike Fisher, who started the British Institute of Anger Management 30 years ago. And I asked him, what is the difference? And he explained to me that anger is communicative. It's our way of telling someone what we need or something that's happened to us that we don't like. But rage is something else entirely. It's destructive. It's intimidating. And he said that rage always comes from unprocessed shame and anger. So rage is just, there's nothing positive to rage, essentially.
And so in that instance, using that as the sort of philosophy behind the rage room, the idea is to have a sort of healthy, safe environment through which to express it. As you say, maybe as an adult, once you feel a bit dirty or uncertain doing that, but clearly, as you say, children maybe feel differently. Is there an age limit to a rage room?
Well, yes, some do, actually. So I went to one in Colchester where children 10 and above could go, but others, there is an age limit. I think maybe rage rooms could be better classified as anger rooms. I think the idea is that you go there to express your anger in order for it not to become rage. So when I spoke to Mike Fisher, I asked him, are rage rooms a healthy thing for people? And he said, well, for people who he described as imploders, i.e. people who sort of internalise their anger, he said he could see it being a good thing. But for people who are exploders, who struggle to contain their rage anyway, he thought not so much, because it might just sort of, you know, allow them to practice their rage more when really they need to find other things to do.
Yes, well, that's sort of what I was wondering about, because I'm the parent of a four-year-old, and I watch him all the time, like learning his emotions. There's a book called The Colour Monster, for example, which tries to help children understand all the different sort of feelings that are going on and bubbling around in their heads. And we encourage him to take a breath rather than, you know, let that anger or rage simmer. And it makes me wonder whether rage rooms, as you say, that idea, is it a short-term answer, a way to sort of express and let erupt that feeling in the moment, or a long-term solution? Because what you obviously don't want to do is train a 10-year-old, for instance, to think smashing things up is okay, so that the next rage room is the living room. So is the idea, yeah, that it depends on the person, the individual, as to whether this is a good fit?
Well, actually, Mike Fisher felt that rage room for imploders would give a short-term release, but probably not a long-term benefit. So he felt, you know, he actually himself does kind of, he calls it emotional release work, that is kind of a rage room setup, but with trained professionals. And he says in that setup, you probably do get a longer term impact. But what I also found interesting from our conversations is he said, you know, he'd struggled with his anger when he was young, which is why he got into this work. And he says that nowadays, if he swallows his anger, even for like 2 days, he says he could notice himself sliding into depression. So speaking to Mike made me think more of that link between unexpressed anger and I guess depression, and also how British people, how bad we are really expressing our anger in the right way, in order for us to do it in a way that benefits us and other people.
Yes, well, I would not be surprised if this is chiming with many, many listeners, especially, of course, at this time of year that we Brits do struggle processing all kinds of feelings, including anger, and the Christmas setting can heighten a lot of that. And interestingly, in your writing, there's some other curious findings of rage rooms. For example, it sounds immediately to me like a new idea, but of course, it turns out it isn't, is it? This is something like this kind of thing has been going on for a while.
Yeah, this was fascinating. So I learned that rage rooms sort of started, or a version of it started, in Japan in the mid 80s. And so basically it was at the height of kind of overwork culture, and officers started having what they called soft rooms, which were padded cells essentially, where salarymen who'd been working like 20 hours a day forever could go into these soft rooms, scream into the void, and then come back to their desk. So apparently these soft rooms don't exist anymore, because the Japanese overwork culture is not as overworky as it once was. But yeah, that was it. And the Japanese culture kind of traditionally, I understand, has prized sort of emotional restraint with high levels of shame, really. So you can see why sort of screaming politely on your own and not disturbing other people might have chimed with where potentially they were at that time.
Yes, not to put a cliche out there, but I always think of the Japanese as a very calm and measured nation. And maybe this is the secret to it, that they've learned how to secretly express and process those feelings. That's really interesting. And another one, which surprised me, was the gender makeup of the people who are going to these new rage rooms, like the one in Colchester. That's curious too, isn't it?
Yeah, I was surprised. So I noted, I had a chat with one of the guys who owns it, and I said, you know, a lot of the things we're smashing up here are household appliances. And he said to me, well, that's because 70% of our clients are women. And for me, that was interesting because I think I initially thought of rage rooms as possibly quite a laddie thing to do. But the reality is it seems to be women who have taken to it the most. And he explained that he's has groups of women sometimes doing divorce or breaking up parties. He said he had one woman who came to the rage room on her own, and she did it after she found out that her husband of 30 years had been having an affair. Some women, I'm guessing some men, have been suggested to go to a rage room by their therapist. Increasingly, he said women are bringing their children. He's doing birthday parties. And another thing that was very interesting is he said four local schools are now sending kids with, you know, kind of life issues, I guess, and attendance issues to the rage room.
See, that is fascinating, isn't it? That idea, again, I think it feels counterintuitive immediately that this could be therapeutic or medicinal for people at various ages. I mean, my hunch would be that the reason maybe women go to these rooms more is because women have a better understanding of not smashing things up outside a rage room. And of course, certain men, whether it's alcohol infused or not, maybe have less restraint in their normal life. And I've got to ask you this as well, Jesse, because I've had an experience is very, very different at the other end of the spectrum. Just over the last weekend for my wife's birthday, we went to a paint room, which was a sort of installation it was in Tunbridge Wells. And you're just, for an hour, encouraged to just paint a wall. And we did it as a family. And it's, again, it's a very simple idea, but it's basically channeling a different emotion. And I wonder whether you think, from your experience of rage rooms, whether this is something you could see happening more of in a more diverse way in our towns and cities, because obviously our high streets they're losing so much that this might be a way of attracting people to express themselves, and there might be money in it. Can you see this sort of thing sort of expanding further in different ways?
Yeah, I mean, I guess as soon as you said it, I was thinking, oh gosh, you know, maybe that is a healthier way of doing things than the rage room. So yes, it does appeal. I mean, I think also there is something, you know, we talked about why women go to rage rooms, and I think part of the reason is that we've not been allowed to be angry, and so rage rooms are expression for that. And I think the same's true of children. You know, children are often, and I've done it myself as a parent countless times, but they're often told to use their words when actually they may not have the words, or they may not be able to. So I think there may be something about, you know, painting the walls rage room that kind of helps them deal with those kind of emotions. And there is something about being allowed to do something that you're not allowed to do at home, where your environment's quite tightly controlled.
And just finally then, if listeners may well be thinking, this is the perfect last minute Christmas present to get someone in the family a rage room present. So you mentioned Colchester. Do you know how far and wide this phenomenon is now in the UK, if people wanted to get involved with this kind of thing?
Yeah, my understanding is it's pretty far and wide, actually. So I think if you Google, you should be able to find rage rooms that are, you know, fairly near you. You know, it is all around the world. I was looking at whether, you know, are rage rooms particular to the UK, and is that because we've got such a problem expressing our anger? But it turns out they seem to be around the world. So yeah, go for it. I think the only thing is the owner of the rage room said to me that people always come into the rage room when it's been bought as a gift, saying, I don't know why somebody's bought this for a gift for me. You know, I'm so not angry. And he says they normally go wild, you know, smashing things up within minutes. So I think we all like to think of ourselves as not having anger problems, but the reality is almost all of us do, probably.
That was Times journalist Jesse Hewitson. Now, is the Christmas number one back, in terms of its importance at least? Because much has been made of the death of the Christmas number one, with Wham's Last Christmas from 1984 having sat in that number one position both last year and the year before. And before that, we had to put up with 3 years of Lad Baby. But now Kylie's festive offering might have breathed new life into the waning Christmas tradition. That was XMAS by Kylie Minogue, as if you didn't know. And that's been crowned number one this year, beating out the Wham classic. With me to discuss it is writer and broadcaster Matt Charlton. Hi, Matt.
Hi there. Yeah, Kylie currently, 17,000 kilometres away as the crow flies in nice hot Australia as opposed to cold, gloomy London celebrating her Christmas number one, yeah.
Yeah, she's celebrating in the right place, isn't she? Well, what do you make of this new song? Is it destined for the pantheon of Slade, Wizard and Jonah Louis?
I think it'll be up there. I think it's going to be, doomed. That's the wrong word, but it's going to be on repeat for a very long time now. It's got there in a very different way to the ones you just mentioned, because that was obviously units shifted in a shop on Christmas Eve or the day before Christmas, number one, usually. This has been Amazon. And Amazon have sort of, I'm not going to say rigged it, but they rigged it. so whenever you say to your digital assistant, who I won't say the name of right now, because she's in the background, you say, play Christmas songs. The first one that it'll play is Kylie, because it was an exclusive deal with them. And that counts towards the streaming numbers, and that counts towards whether it goes to number one or not. But it's a strong enough song to, I would say, it's not up there with Slade, obviously, what could be, but it's up there. It's good. It's Kylie.
Yes, well, that's interesting, isn't it? I think, yeah, well, for all the song's sort of merits or demerits, it seems to be catchy enough and fun enough that it sort of, yeah, may counteract. That is, I mean, that is such a depressing fact that Amazon have, had an interest in it. But, of course, so many Christmas number ones actually have had nothing to do with Christmas. I mean, bizarrely, Pink Floyd, Another Brick in the Wall, that was Christmas number one, as was Reet Petit by Jackie Wilson, and The Pet Shop Boys, Always on
the
My
Beatles
Mind.
The Beatles were number one 5 times with nothing to do with Christmas, yeah. But they held the record until Lad Baby beat them, I say, with a very large chip on my shoulder. And Mad World by Gary Jules, you know, beating the darkness. It's you know, there's a rich history of that too, people being a bit sick of Christmas by the time Christmas comes around.
So what makes a classic Christmas number one then? Is it not, it's not just about it being festive in itself, although sometimes they are. I mean, in the 70s, you couldn't sort of move for them. Or is it something else that makes them enjoyable and that they last? What's the sort of special ingredient?
Well, because I'm really cool, I follow a lot of musicologists on social media, and they were saying there's actually a quicker shift between the minor and the major key in Christmas number ones, because Christmas is about reflection and a little bit of melancholy. And if you listen to a lot of the content of even the biggest Christmas songs, it's about missing someone. So you've got All I Want for Christmas Is You is about missing someone. The Darkness, Don't Let the Bells End, that is about missing someone, and being reflective and having a bit of a tweak on the old heartstrings. So I think that is quite a big thing, which is why maybe these ones that haven't got much to do with Christmas, that are just a bit gloomy, have made it too. And also Rage Against the Machine,
yes,
was a very good one too, because that actually killed the run of the X Factor, and I would say eventually killed the X Factor too. A couple of years later, it really petered out, and that was the first one that the first time that X Factor hadn't made number one during its run.
But my last question then is, are these things cyclical? Because you mentioned Lad Baby, and if you look at the history of the Christmas number one, there's so many great bands and acts in there, but there's also, of course, Bob the Builder and Mr. Blobby. So are we only 2 years or so from Bluey or Dougie taking over the charts? Where are we going with this?
How dare you? Mr. Blobby is one of the finest acts of the 1990s.
Like, he's saying something
like Oasis. it is absolutely cyclical, and there's going to be kids having grown up with a sort of dearth of Christmas number ones saying, I want to write a Christmas song, and they're going to be coming through in a few years' time. And in the meantime, they are still trickling through. I mean, The Darkness, for instance, have done a cover of Mistletoe and Wine this year, which is actually quite fun to listen to. The people growing up who will miss Christmas number one, they'll make Christmas songs, and people will get sick of it again. And then, as you said, Jordan's characters will come out and do them. And so it will go on and on and on. We'll have a K-pop Christmas number one at some point very soon, I'd imagine.
Oh, yes. Place your bets. I can imagine that's exactly where we're going. Well, thank you so much for that, both on what Kylie's like and the past and future of the Christmas number one. That's Matt Charlton. Now, coming up, the best sport to watch this Christmas, plus why your mortgage rate could be going down. That's all after the news with James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. Wes Streeting has openly defied Keir Starmer by backing a UK return to a customs union with the EU, despite the Prime Minister ruling it out. It comes as polling suggests strong support for the move among Labour voters, fueling speculation about the Health Secretary's leadership ambitions. Puppy farms, trail hunting and snare traps are to be banned under new animal welfare reforms. Rural campaigners have called the government's new strategy another attack on the countryside. Police in Australia say a man suspected of killing 15 people during a shooting in Bondi Beach trained for months with his father. They've released images of the pair holding guns as they apparently conducted firearms training. A Russian general's been killed by a car bomb in Moscow. Lieutenant General Fanil Savarov is the third senior military officer to die this year, with investigators saying Ukraine may be behind the attack. 10 people have been helped to safety after a sinkhole opened up beside a canal in Shropshire, swallowing a number of narrowboats. Emergency services declared a major incident this morning after a bank collapsed in Whitchurch and water poured onto neighbouring land. And retailers could be overcharging motorists, according to the competition watchdog. It's found profit margins in the sector remain persistently high and unexplained. And for a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
In areas overwhelmed by conflicts and natural disasters, we can't miss a life-saving moment. As a doctor with Médecins Sans Frontières, I've seen how a moment lost can mean a life lost. Right now, MSF is working across the globe, providing maternity care, containing outbreaks, performing vital surgeries. We can't miss a life-saving moment. MSF needs help. Your help. Every attack, disease, and natural disaster puts more people at risk and calls for our teams to go further and faster. Medical emergencies move quickly. So must we. £50 will keep our work going and make a life or death difference. The life-saving moment is now. To give £50, call 0800 055 7979. That's 0800 055 7979. Or search MSF Urgent. Thank you.
Get a first look at tomorrow morning's front pages. Tonight from 10 with Carol Walker on Times Radio.
Christmas on Times Radio.
It's 2:35 and this is John Harvey, and I'm sitting in for both the Times at One and Jane and Fee for a couple of days. Aren't I a hard worker? And if you love Jane and Fee or you're missing them, why not give their podcast Off Air a go? There's a new episode every Monday to Thursday at around 6 p.m. and you can listen with your local podcast provider of choice. Recently, Fee spoke to Formula One driver Susie Wolf about her propensity for speeding, which is ironic.
Well, I've lost my license before because let's just say I'm not always aware of just how quick I am driving, which can be dangerous and very expensive. So to your point, right now I'm in a good spot, but well, I have been in difficulty in the past.
What does super speed actually feel like? Because most of us won't have driven over. I daren't go over about 65 miles an hour. I'm gripping the steering wheel if I do, Susie. So the notion that your body could be in a machine going at, what would your maximum speed have been?
Just over 300 kilometres an hour.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Okay, what does, oh, that, well, what does it feel like?
I mean, it's difficult for someone to explain to someone that doesn't like speed, because I love the feeling of speed, whether I'm
okay,
on...
Okay, pretend I'm a different person.
Okay, well, if I'm on a mountain skiing or in a car, I just love the acceleration that you get from going fast, the adrenaline that surges through you.
And you can download that and many, many, many other episodes wherever you get your podcasts from. Now, there's that moment at Christmas when you know you've truly overindulged and you could get up and go for a run, maybe meet up for a kickabout, or you could do what I do and just watch the sport on the telly. I mean, it's pretty much the same thing, right? But the key question is what to watch or listen to over this festive feast of sport. Joining me now to discuss is sports journalist Vassos Alexander. Hello, Vassos.
Hello, good afternoon.
Well, thanks for joining us. And I mean, as ever, there's so much to sort of we don't know where to focus our eyes if we're sports fans. So first off, let's start at Ali Pali, because the World's Darts Championship is well underway. What's happening? What can we expect as this proceeds?
Well, I mean, the thing is with the darts, it has become so synonymous with Christmas, hasn't it? I mean, last year, I think I'm right in saying, maybe the year before, Sky Sports advertising campaign was wishing you a merry Dartsmas. And that, you know, that's where they went. Forget the Premier League, wishing you a merry Dartsmas. So it is fantastic. We had Luke Littler, who has absolutely exploded interest in the World Darts in action last night. He won through to the third round. Today we have Paul Lim, who I remember watching went back when there were two World Dance Championships,
yes,
throwing the perfect leg at the Lakeside Country Club in Frimley Green in Surrey, back in the 80s, I think, maybe early 90s. And he's still playing. He's 71 years old now. He won through his first round match, and he will play the world number two, Luke Humphreys, who preceded Luke Littler as world champion. And those two are sort of head and shoulders, the two Lukes, better than everyone else currently on the darts circuit, you would say. So, I mean, a fascinating match and all the fun. Do you know, I remember I was asked, I don't know, about 10 years ago when the darts was on the BBC as well, to be one of the darts commentators. And I didn't really fancy it. So I said no, because I had a good excuse. I was at the tennis in Australia. And then they said, oh, how about next year? And I didn't really have an excuse for that. So I said, well, I'm going to have to do this. And I went along wondering how much I would enjoy it and thinking maybe I would enjoy the sport ironically. And I didn't at all. I just loved it. And now with the advent of Luke Littler over the past couple of years, I think the country, it's the third biggest betting sport in the UK. And the country as a whole has just fallen in love with the razzmatazz and the fancy dress and the absolute absurd walk-on music and the fact that it's really, you know, exciting, good, honest sport, and it's just what we want at this time of year.
Yeah, it's the perfect blend of like extreme skill with that sort of slight pantomime wonderment, and everyone's in the right spirits, often spirits in more ways than one. But I want to ask you something, Vassos, because I'm so glad you mentioned the old BBC tournament at the Lakeside, Frimley Green, because I grew up on that. I didn't have Sky as a kid. I'm like Rishi Sunak, you know, poor me. But the BBC used to host that BDO tournament, which for years was huge. It was very strange, though, that they was this sort of double world championship that never sort of used to mention each other. Have we lost something by there being only one tournament, or was this always inevitable and now everyone follows the same thing? Because it's kind of a shame that not everyone can see it.
Yes, it is a shame that not everyone can see it. And I do slightly miss that sort of that early January. It was on the BBC for years, for decades, and then it moved to Channel 4. And then it slightly sort of quietly died a death, I'm afraid, the BDO World Championship. They moved from Lakeside, who was the sponsor for many years, and they moved to the venue off the O2 in East London, and that just didn't work at all. And the last world champion, Jim Williams, who was promised £100,000 prize money, I think eventually got about £20,000 of that. It just didn't work at all. And then the BDO just sort of quietly ceased to be. It is a shame that not everyone can watch it, because I remember those early January days, because this one goes from before Christmas to just into the new year. And the old one used to go from just at the start of the new year to sort of mid-January. So there was a lot of darts.
Yeah.
They didn't, like you say, they didn't like each other, the two world championships. The PDC, which is the new one, which is the one we're all watching now, that came into being because the likes of Phil Taylor and Eric Bristow and Jockey Wilson, the big names back in the day, they thought they should get automatic entry into the world championships just because they were the big draw. And the BDO said, no, that's not how it works. You have to qualify. And so they said, fine, we'll start our own world championship. And that has now become the PDC, which has just become this great big behemoth. And it's just, look, they do it really well. You know, it's great. But like you say, a shame that not everyone gets it on their tellies.
Yes, it's echoes of what happened in wrestling. I remember in the 90s, WWF and WCW. But obviously, only one winner in the end. But, that's the dart. So what about the rest of the festive sport? Because football's in a slightly different place to normal, isn't it?
Well, and this one tripped me up, the fact that all the Premier League matches are not on Boxing Day like they usually are. So I very confidently told the rest of my family that my son and I, who are season ticket holders at Fulham, would be going to West Ham away at 3 o'clock on Boxing Day. And yes, absolutely, let's all meet up with the in-laws and that side of the family on the 27th. But all the Premier League matches, bar one, are now on the 27th, there's Manchester United who play Newcastle, I think, on Boxing Day, a late one at 8 o'clock. So if you want Boxing Day football, All of the Championship, League One, League Two clubs, they're all playing and pretty much at 3 o'clock. But the Premier League, there's one more match tonight. I'll be at that. Fulham against Nottingham Forest. And then nothing until, bar the Man United game, the 27th, when there's a pretty much full schedule. So, yeah, that one tripped me up. The sort of a lack of Boxing Day football. You know, the broadcasters do what they want with the fixture list. But I think it's just the fact that the 27th is a Saturday. I think that's why they've gone for that.
Yes, well, let's hope, yes, it's just the way that the days have fallen and the dates have fallen. Hopefully the tradition will be back next year, because otherwise, you know, we've mentioned darts and football. We don't want to lose these big sporting traditions. And the last one I want to ask you about, Vassos, thankfully, in one sense, it's still in place, but not thanklessly, the state of play is absolutely abysmal if you're an England fan. It is, of course, the Ashes and the Boxing Day Test. Tell us, can we expect any joy from that if you're an England fan?
Well, I mean, if you are an England fan, you know, Christmas night, 11:30 UK time is when it starts. And do you know, I really don't think so. It's been really, really poor. It's a great shame, you know, that this was the great Ashes series against the weakened Australia. We were going to take Bazball to Australia and win back the Ashes. And it's been kind of record breakingly bad for England fans. I know people who have taken this week specifically and next week off so they could go to Australia and enjoy the Boxing Day test at the MCG. And it's suddenly a dead rubber. Australia have already won the Ashes with two tests to spare. Do you know what? I'll be watching because it's the Boxing Day test, because it's Ashes, and because I'm a sort of eternal optimist. But, I mean, it hasn't been good from an England point of view. They have held their hands up that they made some errors, you know, in preparation and in shot selection, some of the players. And maybe, you know, this is the bottom and it can only get better from here. But it doesn't look likely.
Well, I was going to say, final word on that. Do you think this is a 4-0 or a 5-0 or could there be any hope?
Some of the Aussie players have been saying it's a mentality problem for England in Australia. And it's kind of difficult to disagree with that when you look at what happened. You know, a day and a half into the first test, England were absolutely in control. By the end of that day, they'd lost the first test inside 2 days. And then it's just, you know, gone downhill from there. You know, their little holidays on the beach. It just, in retrospect, it's very easy to say they got that wrong and that wrong and that wrong because they've lost. Is there any hope? I think they'll do well to, you know, I was listening to an interview with Zach Crawley and he said, oh, you never know, you know, we could lose the series 3-2 and people will be saying, well, that's a good series for England. And I remember thinking when I was hearing that, well, no, we won't. We won't be saying that's a good series for England, but at the moment, we'll take it.
Yes, well, they'll take anything. But the good news is, as you say, whether it's Luke Littler or the football or indeed the Ashes, there's plenty to feast upon if sport is your thing. Well, thank you so much for all of that. That's Vassos Alexander. Coming up, why your mortgage rate might be coming down. I'm John Harvey on Times Radio. It's 2:46.
John Pienaar on Times Radio, telling the stories that matter.
How do you rate the seriousness of this situation? Because there have been upsets on the route to this point.
Expert analysis and well-informed discussion.
Half the population are women. It's astonishing that medical misogyny, it persists.
Trusted journalism and diverse opinion.
With the idea that you need to do it now and hope you don't have to do it again.
John Pienaar at Drive, this afternoon from 4 on Times Radio.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Here's to the moment, to the places that give you perspective and the people that change that perspective. Embrace limitless discovery on a Silver Sea voyage with savings of up to 40%. Book between December 3rd, 2025 and February 28, 2026 at silversea.com. Here's to having every reason to celebrate, to finding more. Terms and conditions apply. Selected voyages and fare categories. For full terms and conditions, visit silversea.com/limitlessdiscovery.
Time is ticking, and you're at the point of seriously considering fish print novelty socks, pizza scented candles, or English Railway Tunnels 2026 calendars.
But it'll be funny.
If this is you, stop. You're displaying classic symptoms of last minute Christmas shopping. Here's what you need to do. Go to your nearest Currys and find them a gift they'll love. Just go in-store and pick it up yourself. Last-minute Christmas shopping, done right. in-store at Currys.
Christmas on Times Radio.
It's 2:47 and this is John Harvey. Now, interest rates have fallen for the fourth time this year as the Bank of England reacted to a sharper than expected downturn in inflation. It should mean a fall in the cost of mortgages for many people. Our money doctor, Adam Shaw, is here with a guide to what this means for mortgages. Hello, Adam. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a festive money story. Who would have thought of some potential good
giving
news?
Away stuff. There we are, a little Christmas present from
yes,
the elves there.
Yes, exactly. It's memories of Scrooge or after Christmas.
Yeah, yeah.
Firstly, mortgages are going to fall in cost, but this is not all mortgages. Firstly, this is very much a specific set of people who are going to get benefits in the short term.
Yes. So I give with the headline, I take away with the details, I'm afraid. So, yeah, the base rate, and that's the Bank of England's rate on which most, really, I suppose, all mortgages and indeed current and savings accounts are based. They take their lead from that base rate. That's fallen by 0.25%, and that's very much the direction of travel. It was 4%, we're now 3.75%, and it looks like interest rates might fall again in the coming months as well. So that's the base of that. What actually happens, though, is round about, I think, 3/4 of mortgages are on fixed rate deals. So 1 or 2 year deals. So those people have booked in that time and that won't affect the interest rate until that comes to an end. But it still leaves 1/4 of people who, and that's millions of people, who should see interest rates fall. And indeed, a lot of people, they're coming out of their fixed rate mortgages quite soon. And already, actually, we've seen some good deals. Santander have a 2 year fixed at 3.51%, a 5 year fixed at 3.72%, Nationwide have a 2 year fixed at 3.98%, a 5 year fixed at 4.16%. I know there's a lot of numbers there, but you can see them online. You can see them online, and I've written a blog about this. So we are already seeing interest rates fall, and that should be good news.
Well, let's just look in, because those numbers are just, they sort of float over my head.
Absolutely.
But in terms of the real sort of feeling for this, for people in their pockets, for the 1/4 of people who are on variable rates, who this will immediately impact, so they will see an immediate fall?
Yeah.
And what sort of money are we talking about?
Okay, so this is a very good question, because often, actually, what happens is, when interest rates are rising, we go, hold on a second, you're very quick, actually, to raise when it benefits the bank, and suddenly my bank account, which has an interest rate paying, doesn't respond so quickly. But I think already we've seen some movement, and that's quite good. In terms of the actual effect on people, it depends how much you've borrowed, but if we're saying around about £100,000, I think for every £100,000 of mortgage, this would probably save you in the region of £180 a year. So these are not life-changing sums, but it all adds up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're probably not on a mortgage of £100,000. You're probably on something much more in advance of that, probably five times that. So you're suddenly talking about £700, £800 savings a year. And that comes, you know, that's a nice thing to have.
Yes, it's funny. It's two things, isn't it? People will think immediately, well, any money saved is a good thing, particularly if something as big as a mortgage.
Yeah.
But at the same time, people's debts at the moment, in a cost of living crisis that hasn't eased, £180 a year, it barely causes a scratch on the surface of their money issues.
That's true. But I think your wider point is well made in that mortgaging is a type of debt.
Mm-hmm.
And often we see it as a good debt because you go, well, your asset is going to rise in value. There's a whole bunch of other debt where you're, especially at this time of year when you might be borrowing just to buy Christmas presents and to keep the wheels turning in the home, and you're not investing in an asset. And those have been very expensive debts, and hopefully this will reduce. I mean, when you're buying, most of us, I suppose, now, or certainly millions of us, are buying on credit cards, you're paying 20-25% interest if you don't clear that debt at the end of the month. So a 0.25% fall isn't really going to make a hell of a lot of beans of difference here. But the direction of travel is good, and generally, it's a subject for another time, but generally, I wouldn't be advising to borrow on credit cards anyway.
Right. Your phrase there, the direction of travel, is interesting to many listeners, I'm sure, because, say, for example, you're on a fixed mortgage, as you were describing, and it's just coming to to the end of its term. I mean, it's so unfortunate we live in a world where finance is a kind of a horrible game we all have to play. Yeah. But would you suggest to people they need to be looking in the market for when to fix? Can you, for example, go variable rate for a short time before you then take another fix if you believe the bank might cut it by another quarter percent? How should people navigate this? Because it's so complex, and over years, this really can add up.
It can make a big difference. It's complex and it's boring, to be honest. I mean, you know, who wants to talk about mortgages? I'm not sure even mortgage brokers don't come home and go, darling, I must talk to you about the latest mortgage rate. Right. So it's super boring, but it is sort of life changing as well. Really, some time spent working this out can save you thousands of pounds and change your financial outlook. So in answer to your question, yes, you can have a look at going on a variable rate and then going, well, let's ride this wave for a little bit and then see if we can fix it at a later stage. And indeed, more than that, I would suggest, don't wait. If you're on a fixed rate, or on any rate, I suppose, you don't have to wait until the moment you need that mortgage to book it in. The mortgage charter now allows you to effectively reserve a price. You go, oh, that's a great price. I'm going to reserve that for 3 months' time. Now, let's say you change your mind or the market changes and you go, actually, what I thought was a great deal is no longer a great deal. This is a great bit of consumer protection. You're not committed to it. The bank is, but you are not. You can go, actually, I changed my mind. I don't want any of that. You can walk away from that deal.
Okay.
So it is good to look ahead and to see what's coming ahead. But I think there's a bigger thing behind your question than actually money. And that is, I think, the greatest benefit of a fixed rate deal is the sort of psychological benefit it brings. So clearly, you can guess where interest rates are going. You might get that wrong. You might get that right. You've got to remember the banks are also guessing what rates. So if we think they're going to fall, the banks also think they're going to fall. Mm-hmm. So that's built into the market. But I think there are some other things to consider. For years, I was on a fixed rate mortgage. And the truth was, I lost money all the way through that fix. But I was still glad I did it because I'm a freelancer. My income can go up, it can go down. I'm by nature a worried person. And I go, I don't want to go to sleep at night going, oh, we're going to afford the mortgage. So there are some interesting, I think, benefits from having a fixed. And that is you have some budgetary certainty and you have sort of cash flow. You know your monthly payments are going to be the same. You have a protection from shocks in the market. And we're living at a time of huge volatility in the political landscape. Who knows what's going to happen in Ukraine, with Russia, with China? We don't know. And those things could have a very direct effect on inflation, and that will immediately impact interest rate perspectives.
Well, we saw that with the mini budget, didn't we, where domestic policy can have...
Domestic policy definitely has a very direct influx on that, but even things you think was nothing to do with me. What happens in Venezuela, for instance? Why would that affect me? Well, it can affect oil, that affects inflation. We import inflation, suddenly the bank can't reduce interest rates as much. So it has those, and it makes for easier longer-term planning commitments as well. So I think that is why, actually, the majority of people buy a fixed rate, actually not because they're suddenly fantastic economists who know where interest rates are going, but psychologically it goes, I can afford that, that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah, you're sort of paying for the peace of mind as much as
anything. There can be a premium. You can actually benefit financially, but I think you're right. There is a sort of, you may, even if it's you're paying a premium on that, you're buying some certainty and peace of mind. And if you're close to your affordability levels, going, if it went up much more, that would be a problem. That would be something to build into your thinking.
Well, in terms of our thinking then, I mean, what evidence is there about how savvy we generally are as a population, mortgage owners, mortgage buyers are, when looking for the best deal? Because as you say, it's very complicated.
Yeah.
People don't have a lot of time. How do the Brits generally navigate this? And are we sort of as clued up as we should be?
No, and we're rubbish at this. I think the FCA, which is the city regulator, did a study a year or two ago and said 370,000 mortgage holders could save well over £1,000 by switching. There also seems to be, and I don't quite believe this number, but I did find this and it seemed responsibly sourced. Something like 500,000 mortgage holders are on what's called the SVR, the standard variable rate. And that's what you default to. You usually get a discount floating rate for a while. That's what you were talking about.
Right.
And if you do nothing, you default to a terrible rate. And this terrible rate is the SVR. Now, if 500,000 people are on this SVR, it suggests that they've just done nothing and are paying well over the odds. So that's what I was saying is, it isn't the most exciting thing to do, but if you're about to go on a holiday, maybe in the days after Christmas, you find a quiet spot. Mm-hmm. You could change your financial outlook by just spending a bit of time looking at that and not be defaulting to these very high penalty rates.
And just on that, because I do think it's in so many walks of life, people are, we're all penalised by just not checking. That defaulting thing is awful. And maybe something, you know, government should be protecting us from from the fact that if we're not savvy enough, that the big companies should be sort of benefiting from that. That does seem strange to me. But in terms of looking around for deals, let me just quickly ask you about this one. That say, as you mentioned, you're a freelancer, so am I. To what extent is it even possible for people to sort of look around at other lenders when, for that, you might have to do all the credit checks? Or, and if your income is, like so many listeners will be, fluctuating wildly, they might not be able to get another rate.
Well, looking around, you don't have to fill out the forms. You can see what rates you're going to get if we're talking about mortgages, really online on a couple of comparison sites. You might also want to use a broker who will do a lot of that legwork for you. If you are using a mortgage broker, I'd really make sure you're going to one where you're not paying. So there are some which charge you and charge the mortgage company for introducing the business. There are others which just charge the mortgage company and you pay no more for that. So if you're going to use a mortgage broker, make sure you're not paying them and you're not paying over the odds, and they will do a lot of the donkey work for you. And they'll also, it's in their interest, when the mortgage deal sort of ends, they will contact you and remind you.
Well, that's lots of, it's not the greatest Christmas discussion.
No, that's not a festive way. But look, money, you know, it's nice to save up. And, you know, that's a nice little Christmas present. Let's frame it like that.
That's a good way to look at it and to make the new year a good one. Thank you so much as ever. Right. It's our money doctor, Adam Shaw.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock and you're listening to John Harvey on Times Radio. Still to come in the final hour of the programme, we'll speak to a dead ringer who was part of the Royal Variety performance broadcast last night, where an impression of Sir Keir Starmer was booed. How should you support a family member struggling with addiction at Christmas? We'll speak to the CEO of the charity, The Forward Trust. And we'll also get a rundown of the best books of the year and find out why going to the cinema is the perfect festive activity. But first, the news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. Wes Streeting has openly defied Sir Keir Starmer by backing a UK return to a customs union with the EU, despite the Prime Minister ruling it out. It comes as polling suggests strong support for the move among Labour voters, fueling speculation about the Health Secretary's wider ambitions. Tony Blair's former Europe Minister Dennis McShane told Times Radio Sir Keir Starmer needs to be bold.
It's not a magic solution. Nonetheless, the hit to our economy is clear. So many firms have just not able to have to shut down because they can't trade as once they did. And all the promised jobs and investment from Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage have not arrived, are not going to arrive. So what do? Just become poorer, sort of sadder, decay gently into irrelevance?
Meanwhile, industrial action by resident doctors has ended after 5 days with staff returning to work across England. Doctors walked out amidst a flu epidemic, adding to seasonal pressure on the NHS. Mr. Streeting says he's determined to restart talks to resolve the dispute over pay and conditions. Dr. Leila McKay is Director of Policy, Leadership and Improvement at the NHS Confederation.
There certainly has been a really significant amount of disruption. There's had to be a large focus on how to keep everything staffed, keep everyone safe, prioritise the most emergency, urgent cases, which of course, as you can imagine, has led to significant numbers of people having their less urgent care having to be postponed or cancelled. And all of that, of course, will have to be rescheduled in the new year.
A Russian general has been killed by a car bomb in Moscow. Lieutenant General Fanil Savarov was head of the Operational Training Directorate at the Russian Armed Forces General Staff. Investigators say they're following a number of lines of inquiry, including that Kyiv's intelligence services were behind the attack. Samuel Romani from the Defence Research Group, RUSI, says if it was the Ukrainians, they'd be trying to expose vulnerabilities.
We already saw that with multiple assassination attempts and assassinations that have been carried out inside the Russian-occupied territories too, which are kind of aimed at kind of giving partisan resistance a degree of hope. So when they go after officials in Kherson or Zaporizhia, that's kind of what you're seeing.
The US has confirmed it's actively tracking a third oil tanker off Venezuela. It's part of Donald Trump's push to blockade all sanctioned vessels as he accuses the country of using oil money to fund drug-related crime. Thousands of Venezuelans opposed to President Nicolas Maduro are being detained in the South American nation. Lawyer Gonzalo Himeop says most of his cases are investigations into suspected terrorism.
This is a very clear maneuver from the government in order to establish this narrative that everybody that is against them or protests against the government is a terrorist.
And the singer Chris Rea, who sang Driving Home for Christmas, has died at the age of 74. A spokesperson for his family says he died earlier today in hospital following a short illness. In a statement on behalf of his wife and two children, he says it is with immense sadness that we announce the death of our beloved Chris. He passed away peacefully in hospital earlier today, surrounded by his family. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Hello, it's 4 minutes past three, and this is John Harvey on Times Radio. And I'm with you for one more hour of the very best in news, features, culture and comment until the great John Pienaar takes over at four. That sound you're hearing just underneath me needs no introduction. It is, of course, I Will Always Love You by Whitney Houston, which was Christmas number one in 1992. And, by the way, that song offers an excellent party game to play with friends and family this Christmas. All you have to do is try and guess one at a time when the drum comes in before the big key change chorus at the end. Whoever gets closest wins. I dare you to try it. It's brilliant. Also coming up, I'll be talking to one of the stars of the brilliant comedy impressions team, Dead Ringers, off the back of the mere mention of Keir Starmer getting a resounding boo at the Royal Variety performance. Then later in the show, I'll be speaking to Mike Trace, CEO of the Forward Trust, who will be joining me to talk about the problems of addiction at the festive season, both for affected families and addicts themselves. Plus, film and music journalist Clara Amfro will give us her tips for what to watch this holiday season and why there's a special magic about going to a cinema to do it. And there's a soupçon of extra suspense in today's show, because while I'm here spending the afternoon with you on the radio, my wonderful wife Sarah is very, very pregnant with our second child. Shepherds and mangers on standby. Have you got any Christmas birthdays or stories in your life? Do keep yours coming in. Any words of encouragement for mums to be out there, I am all ears. You can WhatsApp me on 0333 003 2353. You can text us on 87222, start your message with the word Times, or you can email studio@times.radio. But now, it's been a rough weekend for Keir Starmer, who was booed at the Royal Variety performance despite not being in the room. Comedy impressionists from the Dead Ringers radio show were on stage, and this is how the audience reacted when Duncan Wisby began his impression of the Prime Minister.
And Sir Keir Starmer. Thank you very much. It's so lovely to be here.
Well, that was Duncan Wisby, and one of Duncan's colleagues, the brilliant Lewis McLeod, joins us now. Hello, Lewis.
Hey, John, how you doing?
I'm very good. Happy Christmas, and thank you so much for joining us. Now, I mean, Dead Ringers at the Royal Variety performance, I mean, what an incredible thing for you guys to do in the first place. But what did this moment strike you as? It seemed like, I've watched the clip, I mean, it looked like you guys were genuinely surprised.
Yeah. I don't know. Somebody made the joke. It was like a rally, but it was kind of bizarre. And But hey, it was in the season of pantomime. It was a proper pantomime moment, wasn't it? It was like the panto villain getting the boo. No, I loved it. I thought it was great. And I thought that, I think Duncan handled it so, I thought he handled it so well and chose just a little pause and then came back with a bigger laugh than the boo got, which is always great.
I mean, it's just incredible. It's one of those things where it's a real barometer of the public's view of celebrities. But I imagine for you, as I mean, listeners may well know, you are that I would say the preeminent impressionist around. I mean, you're so brilliant, and obviously we're going to hear a little bit more in a moment. But do you find that by being an impersonator, you have a unique insight into how people look at celebrities, whether there's any sort of lingering affection as well as the mockery?
Well, that's really the writers. They are so good. We have, I think, the best writers in the world. We have a team that can say, look, this might emerge. This might be a great conflation if you take certain ideas. We had one on Ringers, you know, Truss working for Farage. You know, anything that involves a sort of cross-pollination of ideas that are, as you would say, zeitgeisty, the writers are going to capture that. And we just happen to be in the fortunate position where we just take the material we're given and we can make suggestions, but they really are the ones that just put their heads together and come up with these brilliant set pieces that just capture the public's imagination and indeed echo how they're feeling at that time.
But it must be, I would have thought, a really incredible sort of balancing act between the writers and you guys being able to pull off this sort of vocal gymnastics that you all do. And people, I think, generally seem to think that maybe until recently we were living in an era of less interesting politicians, and it was not such a golden age for mimicry. But of course, these days we have quite a cast of characters. And would you say Starmer, almost surprisingly, through his maybe the monotony of his voice, clearly he's clearly got an easily gettable one to the ear. Is it a fun one for Duncan to do? And do you do a Keir?
Yeah, I think Duncan's is the best around. I think he's, when we're on the tour, there's a lovely moment where we get to just chat to the audience and explain how we do it, because it's something that technically we don't really get asked to do it. Certainly don't get asked to do it on Ringers. But when we're on the tour, there is a moment where the audience get to sort of learn how we achieve those voices. And Duncan's got so many observations about how you get Starmer's voice, and they're all brilliant. And it always gets a round of applause because it's kind of brilliant. You know, he has this way of, he does this thing with his breath. He sort of, you know, he does. I don't do that. I think he sounds like the droid that races through Chewbacca's feet in Star Wars.
Oh, yes,
also,
that little, yes.
You know the one, it's like the little, there was a guy with a remote control going, that's it, there we go. I think that, hello. I mean, I did him on Private Eye Live, and it's I guess that thing, you've got to really have the caricature to hand, for me at least. So you can get a combination of it being vocally accurate, but there is something characterful to hang the writing on.
Well, and let me ask you then about two of your biggest, of course, because it's one thing to do the radio show. Many listeners will know Dead Ringers has been an institution on radio, on TV for a long time. But to do it at the Royal Variety Performance is such a big stage. And two of, I would say, possibly the two most loved impressions are yours. A certain Boris Johnson, and although it's a crowded field for Trump impersonators, no one beats yours. So let's can you give us a blast of each of those. Let's have Boris first. Mr. Johnson, if you're there, how is your Christmas? And Lewis, tell us how you achieve a bojo.
Well, I'd like to say thank you, first of all, John, for that. Sterling introduction. And I find that the stutter always helps, where he's thinking about what to say and throwing in these ridiculous noises, which started out as capital P-H-W-A-A-A-H, which we've just run with, and it's become the ding ding so really, anything that Boris can say must be punctuated, in my view, with the stutter, but with this ridiculous concoction of bad hands at Scrabble, in order to achieve the comic vitality, John.
I mean, that's fascinating that it is almost those, as you say, the vocal tics, like as you say, Keir Starmer having that the words getting stuck in his throat, and Johnson. Is that for you as a performer? Is that how you guys disarm us as an audience? That we're almost laughing despite ourselves before any even material has come out. And Jan Ravens does it when she does her Kirsty walk, doesn't she? She'll just read out a song lyric in Kirsty's tones, and she's got us in the palm of her hand. Is that all part of your skill?
I think so. I think once you've established it with Diane Abbott, there was almost a sort of rule of three with Andrew Neil joining us, the man who invented cheese, the first person in history to be called Roger, and the, you know, and then there'll be a third one, and then it's and Diane Abbott. So that would, you would get a cheer. She would literally get a cheer before she's even said anything, because of we've had that with David Davis, the Brexit Bulldog. Yeah. You know, there's a few of them that do elicit that from the audience, and I think that's so joyful and great fun. Again, it plays to the absolute kind of far reaches of the character comedy of it all. But it's always great fun when they do that. You know, I love that moment. You know,
well, and above all, we can't not mention the Donald, who I am delighted to say we have a Times Radio exclusive that President Trump is joining us. So, Mr. President, do you have any message for us this Christmas? And indeed, how you, your good friend Lewis McLeod, manages to capture you so well?
Well, thank you so much, John. That's a very kind thing. And let's be honest, I've had a bit of a tricky past and present and future with the times, let's say. But I'm very grateful. You've been very kind. And, you know, it's Christmas. It's the season of goodwill, of which I'll give you none. But, of course, people say, how many Trumps can you have at the dinner table? I'd say none if you lay off the Brussels sprouts. But, of course, it's a very beautiful thing. I wake up on Christmas morning, I lean over, I give Melania a kiss on the face. Time. You know, we're in opposite ends of the White House. It's the only way we can stay in touch. But, you know, it's a season. That's what it is. And it is the season to get jelly. Jelly. I mean, you could, you know, we could just, whatever, you give me a subject, we could riff on it for seconds, you know.
But, well, it's wonderful in a way to hear from the president. And Lewis, thank you so much for giving us an insight both into your craft and the wonders and intrigue of the Royal Variety performance. That is the master mimic, writer and actor Lewis McLeod, part of the Dead Ringers team. Now, as you may have heard in the news, singer Chris Rea, whose songs include the festive hit Driving Home for Christmas, has died at the age of 74, a spokesperson for his family said. Here's a taste of that famous song.
Driving home for Christmas. Oh, I can't wait to see those faces.
Well, let's reflect on his life and welcome back Matt Charlton, writer and music journalist. Hello, Matt.
Hi there. I wasn't expecting to be back this soon and with this sadder news.
No, absolutely. What a change in tone, because we were talking festive hits and this is right up there in the classics, isn't it? Chris Rea's Driving Home for Christmas. It means so much to so many people. I mean, it's so awful for it to happen at this time of year, isn't it?
And it seems to happen so often. We lost George Michael on Christmas Day in 2016 too. But yeah, Chris Rea is now the byword. I mean, what goes with Chris Rea now, especially in this country, is Driving Home for Christmas. And as you said, it's actually quite an emotive song in a very different way to the Christmas number ones we were talking about earlier that were tinged with a bit of melancholy and loss. This is quite a hopeful song, and it really works on the radio at Christmas, as you'll mostly find yourself stuck in your car going somewhere. So it was a bit of a masterstroke on his part to write such a song.
Yes, it's funny, isn't it? He always has that the two sides of a coin with Driving Home for Christmas, which is sort of charming and sort of and sort of very plinky. But he's also, of course, known for The Road to Hell and a lot else besides. I mean, he's a rock god, isn't he, Chris Rea?
He's snuck in there as such, I think, definitely, because he was known for different things on either side of the Atlantic, I would say. He depends on your nationality. For Americans, he's this balladeer, for a fall if you think it's over, which was, as you said, soft rock. But he knows for his, he's known in this country for his guitar and introspection and obviously Driving Home for Christmas too, which is a huge thing. The last time I saw him was actually on Gone Fishing, the Bob Mortimer, Paul Whitehouse thing, the Christmas special a few years ago, which is hopefully on iPlayer somewhere. And they went to visit him and had a chat with him because I think he's a Northeast boy. He was a Northeast boy. Mm. So it really, it chimed with Bob Mortimer, who grew up around there too. And it was a nice thing. So they went to see him in this sort of quiet pub for a Christmas special. And it was a very, very down to earth guy, I think.
Yes, he does give that impression. And I mean, he had such an interesting career. And I know from my sort of film geekery side of things, he even tried his hand at acting, taking the lead, believe it or not, in a film directed by Michael Winner called Parting Shots. It was in, I think, 1998, 99. It was the penultimate film of Oliver Reed. Bob Hoskins was in it. John Cleese, Joanna Lumley. It was an incredible cast. And it was led by Chris Rea. So he did turn his hand to many things in his life. I wouldn't say acting was necessarily his forte as much as his brilliant music. But would you say he would be known as mostly as a guitarist or as a songwriter or as an album musician? Where do you think people will... I'm sure people will be listening to him over the festive season and not just Driving Home for Christmas. Where do you think people's sort of affections will lie with him?
I think definitely as a balladeer. I think it's the voice, the very gravelly and unique voice that you will instantly know it is Chris Rea, especially with The Road to Hell. But yes, as a soft rock balladeer, quite synonymous with the 1980s, but a real talent and a real gentleman too.
Yes, well, thank you so much for sharing your immediate thoughts. As Matt Charlton, writer and music journalist, on the sad news of the passing of Chris Rea. Coming up, how to support a loved one who might be struggling with addiction at this time of year. I'm John Harvey on Times Radio. It's 3:19.
Boxing Day Breakfast with Rosie Wright on Times Radio.
To help you digest and unwind from the excitement of Christmas Day, join me, Rosie Wright, for Boxing Day Breakfast at home with four generations of the Wrights.
Join Rosie Wright live on Boxing Day morning as she brings you all the latest news, views and interviews as the festive season continues. Boxing Day Breakfast with Rosie Wright. Boxing Day from 7 a.m. on Times Radio.
Simplify making tax digital for income tax with Xero. If you're a sole trader or landlord, you'll need to use HMRC recognized software like Xero to track your income and expenses, share quarterly updates, and submit your final tax return. Xero accounting software gives you a clear view of your financial picture, and with each quarterly update, you'll see your estimated tax bill, helping to avoid those nasty year-end surprises. Simply snap, scan, and sort receipts on your phone and on the go, so your records stay organized all year round, putting an end to the January panic and the piles of paperwork. With Xero, go beyond compliance and gain better control of your business finances. Your records stay up to date automatically, invoicing and payments run online, and a better view of your numbers helps you plan ahead. Less scramble at year end, more confidence all year. Change the way you see making tax digital with Xero. Search MTD Ready.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
This is Times Radio.
It's 3:21 and this is John Harvey. Thanks so much for your messages so far in the show. Barrett's just been in touch to say he thoroughly enjoyed the impressions of Bojo and President Trump from the brilliant Lewis McLeod. And Ali has been in touch to say Chris Rea's guitar playing always reminded him of Mark Knopfler and Dire Straits. Rest in peace. And Aid has also mentioned his sadness about Chris Rea passing away, saying, "I saw him many years ago live in Sheffield in 1978 as he just got a recording contract." And if you want to get in touch, please do. You can WhatsApp us on 0333 003 2353. You can text us 87222, start your message with the word Times, or you can email studio@times.radio. Now, while Christmas can be the happiest time of year for millions of homes, it can also be a pressure point, or worse, for families affected by alcohol and other addictions. I can speak personally on this, as I grew up with a dad who was a very heavy drinker, and it cast an especially huge shadow over this time of year.
Mike Trace is CEO of the Forward Trust, a social justice charity that supports people to recover from addiction or leave behind crime, helping them to move on in life with family, friends and beyond. And Mike joins me now. Hello, Mike.
Good afternoon, John.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And it's really good to speak to you, particularly now, because please tell us from your perspective, why can Christmas be such a difficult time for those with addiction?
Well, a lot of the people who struggle with addiction, whether it to be to drugs, alcohol, gambling or other addictions, the root causes are in sort of mental health problems around anxiety or depression or loneliness and other sort of life traumas. A lot of people struggling with what we call adverse childhood experiences. Now, obviously, Christmas can be a time where you get together with people and feel a good connection, but for many people, it's the opposite of that. You're feeling particularly lonely or left out or reminded of bereavements or other things. So it can be a trigger for a lot of people to actually make the drinking or drug use worse.
And what's your advice from your perspective again, if you, a listener there out right now, or a family member is struggling with alcohol or other addictions at Christmas this year, what can they do?
Well, the main message is reach out for help. People will know that they're struggling and won't know where to seek help. And obviously, ideally, you get that from the people around you, your friends, your family. But if you feel you need other support or professional help, every town and city in the country has got a specialist drug advice service, a helpline, a drop-in centre. And if you just Google it for your own town, find out who the service are that works in your own town, go out and talk to them. Try and get in touch with people who've got their own recovery from addiction. There's a big community out there. We always hear about Narcotics Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous, but there's all sorts of support groups out there, and these are people who've been through it, come out the other side, and are willing to help and support others. So my advice for anybody out there who's struggling is reach out for that help. It's out there.
Well, I'm sure that is a relief to lots of people to know that. And in the age of the internet, people can find resources better than perhaps they certainly could in, say, when I was a child in the 80s and 90s. But there is something else going on here, isn't there, Mike, which is that although help might be available more than it used to be, a lot of people feel that they can't reach out. There are huge taboos. And I know from my family experience, a lot of secrecy can surround addictions and wanting to not sort of there's shame and wanting to put on a brave front. It can be hard to break those down. How can families sort of cope and navigate that if they would like to reach out, but for their own reasons, they feel that they can't?
Well, that's absolutely true. The surveys we do and people we speak to, the shame and the stigma of admitting that there's an addiction and admitting the problems that go along with it, that is the biggest barrier to people reaching out for help. And to the people suffering, I'd urge them to get past that stigma. Is most people you'll find are very sympathetic and very willing to help, as I say, particularly people who've been through similar experiences themselves. And to everybody else out there, when you are faced with somebody who's clearly drinking too much or struggling with drugs or gambling, you know, try to give a compassionate approach. Try to understand where they're coming from, why the behavior is happening, and offer that end, that hand of support. So trying to get through that stigma is the most important thing, because people suffering in silence and often not coming through it, not being able to resolve it because they never knew how to reach out for help. That's the most damaging thing.
Well, you mentioned, and it's shame, I think, is one of the key words here. But I think there's also a lot of fear, because do you think there are a lot of families out there? There's so much love in families who are afflicted by these kinds of traumas. And I imagine, and again, I can speak from personal experience on this, that there is a fear that by reaching out, it could have unintended consequences, that maybe there might be a more extreme reaction from whether it's the authorities or support groups than they would want. Is that another part of the taboo? Maybe like there's more education that we need in what the actual help would result? Because I imagine people might think, oh goodness, there's almost better the devil they know. Is there something like that going on?
Well, that fear is real, and once again, a broadly reassuring message is when you do surveys of people about how they would react if a friend or family confided in them, you always get a very supportive response. Now, we've all probably seen things, and people have experienced things where people have been unsympathetic and reacted negatively, and people might be in fear of losing their jobs or being reported to police. 99% of the times, that's not what happens. Most people understand that people struggling with a mental health problem, the help is what is needed. The other fear I think I should mention is, of course, people who've come to view alcohol or drugs as a crutch, as a way of avoiding their own negative feelings or problems they don't want to confront. Of course, the fear is of giving up that crutch. You know, if alcohol has become your way of coping with something that you find difficult, leaping away from that and saying, well, I'm going to try and recover or deal with the addiction or confront it, that is a very scary process, but it's a much easier process if you're doing it with other people that you have a connection with.
Yes, that makes sense, and hopefully is some reassurance to any listeners struggling. And finally, let me just ask you, Mike, you are the chief executive of the Forward Trust. Tell us what your organisation does to help those who personally suffer from addiction and indeed the families who are caught up in the horrors.
Well, Forward Trust are one of these organisations who offers professional help. We do it very much from the what we call the peer support angle. So around 40% of all of our staff are people who've been through addiction before or been through alcohol problems before. So we are a charity. We've got projects all around the country that offer this sort of help and try and create a community, a network of people who all support each other in their recovery. We call it recovery. We're a charity. We do as much as we can to help as many people as possible. We helped 35,000 people last year. And a lot of our work is in prisons and other parts of the criminal justice system and with homeless people. So we deal with people who, you know, are struggling on the front line. And we offer that pathway to recovery. And it's a wonderful thing when you see thousands of people who take up that help and support and find ways of turning things around. Our phrase is always, recovery is out there. You know, go for it.
Oh, that's a very positive message. And one last thing, just a word on the fact that I think role models can be a huge impact on this, and particularly with families, knowing that there is a pathway. And if I'm right, Tony Adams is helping the charity now, isn't he? What's Tony bringing?
He's our chairman, and he's a role model. He's somebody who's broken through that fear. He's written two books now, I think, about how as a high-profile, successful sportsman, while he was winning trophies and playing for England, the captain of England, he was absolutely addicted to alcohol, and that ended up with him serving some time in prison. So he's now our chairman. He's a great role model and a story for somebody who took the leap, had those conversations, asked for help, and 20-odd years later, he's a very successful businessman, supporter of all sorts of charities, and speaks very openly about his experience. So you couldn't get a finer role model to work with Forward Trust.
Well, I can just say thank you so much for the great work you're doing with the organisation, and indeed for shining a light on such an important issue this festive season and beyond. That's Mike Trace, who is the Chief Executive of the Forward Trust. Coming up, we'll take a look back on the best books of 2025. But first, let's get a check on the latest news headlines with James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. The singer-songwriter Chris Rea, who's known for his festive hit Driving Home for Christmas, has died at the age of 74. In a statement, his family says he'd been in hospital following a short illness. Tony Blair's former Europe Minister Dennis McShane has told Times Radio Britain rejoining a customs union with the EU is an idea worth exploring. It comes as the Health Secretary Wes Streeting has openly defied Keir Starmer by backing the move, despite the Prime Minister ruling it out. Puppy farms, trail hunting and snare traps are to be banned under new animal welfare reforms. Rural campaigners have called the government's new strategy another attack on the countryside, but Thomas Schulz-Jager from the RSPCA supports tighter regulation for the dog trade.
Looking at voluntary commitments to outlaw these extreme breeding practices, flat-faced dogs, for example, is really important because we know of the suffering that those animals go through.
A Russian general has been killed by a car bomb in Moscow. Investigators say they're following a number of lines of inquiry, including that Ukraine's intelligence services were behind the attack, although Kyiv hasn't commented. And people are being asked to avoid parts of Whitchurch in Shropshire following the collapse of a canal bank. Emergency services say at least two boats were swallowed by a 50-metre sinkhole, but no casualties have been reported. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
In areas overwhelmed by conflicts and natural disasters, we can't miss a life-saving moment. As a doctor with Médecins Sans Frontières, I've seen how a moment lost can mean a life lost. Right now, MSF is working across the globe, providing maternity care, containing outbreaks, performing vital surgeries. We can't miss a life-saving moment. MSF needs help. Your help. Every attack, disease, and natural disaster puts more people at risk and calls for our teams to go further and faster. Medical emergencies move quickly. So must we. Just £30 will keep our work going and make a life or death difference. The life-saving moment is now. To give £30, call 0800 055 7979. That's 0800 055 7979. Or search MSF Urgent. Thank you.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
It's just coming up to 3:34 and this is John Harvey. And now it's time to enter our literary salon for the afternoon. So pour yourself a glass of fizz, alcoholic or not, your choice, and lay back and enjoy Alex Clark coming onto the show, a literary journalist and host of the TLS podcast. Welcome, Alex. And you've got some Christmas books to get us in the mood, haven't you?
Well, I have. I thought I would talk to you about things that you might, at the very last minute, want to put into your shopping basket.
Yes, please.
For someone's stocking. And also things that you yourself might just want to. I'm planning to go to the greenhouse when it all gets too much, you see. And
lucky you.
I know. Well, like, you know, it's under the, I've got to fetch some ice, I say,
okay,
from the garage, and then, you know, sugar up the path and then you're not seen again. It's,
I mean,
great.
For all I know, the greenhouse is the name of your local Wetherspoons, so you know, that might be code, who knows.
I have chosen first a real fun book by Nicola Upson, who's a mystery writer. She writes novels inspired by the great whodunit writer Josephine Tay. And her new novel is it's a novella, really. It's a short novel. It's called A Christmas Clue. And it's set in wartime in 1943. And it's about a couple who decide to put on a sort of mystery weekend, one of those whodunit weekends. Mm-hmm. And as you might imagine, things don't go quite according to plan.
Well, that sounds great, the idea that a short novel, I mean, some might say that's in a very cynical commercial measure to put that out. But, you know, that's the kind of book, I mean, we're talking what, the Christmas season, pre-Traitors. There isn't apparently an Agatha Christie on the TV, a new one anyway, this season. So this could potentially fill a hole
But actually, in that vein, I have another one for you. It's Sophie Hannah. It's called The Last Death of the Year. And so Sophie Hannah, who writes thrillers, contemporary thrillers, you know, in her own identity, as it were, also writes continuation novels with Hercule Poirot at their centre. She writes the new Hercule Poirot mysteries, and this is her latest. And it is set, as the title suggests, The Last Death of the Year. It's set in a slightly alternative community in very hot weather, a sort of almost cult-like community where forgiveness is the message, but that doesn't quite extend to the drama that ensues when a body is found. And I found that highly enjoyable. I'm going back a little bit further. If you you want something really Christmassy themed,
yes,
I'm sure lots of readers will be fans, as I am, of Janice Hallett's mysteries, which are put together in a really ingenious way that the stories go forward by means of text messages, emails, phone messages. There's not a sort of one narrative that you have to piece things together from everybody's communications with everybody else. And she wrote a very, very, very popular book called The Appeal, and then she reprised it a couple of years ago in The Christmas Appeal. So clever. There's another one. There's your threesome of Christmas-themed mysteries.
Excellent. Well, let me sort of compare then these modern books that have come out, which might be, as you say, a perfect last-minute present, with the classics and, of course, the ultimate classic, Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, which I'm sure will be under millions of trees. But does it actually stack up? If you wanted to read a bit of Dickens now, is it harder work than something like Nicola Upson or Janice Hallett, or should readers not be scared by the fact that they're reading something from the 19th century? Because I think there is a stigma there.
Well, look, I mean, Dickens was the ultimate communicator. He did not write his novels to appear in one great chunk as we think of them these days, in huge volumes that you might think, you know, it's a little bit daunting. They were written in newspaper serial form, and they were written to be consumed. Now, A Christmas Carol is obviously, it's a much shorter book. There's another book of his, The Chimes, which is a kind of similar sort of story. You know, the idea of somebody being brought into sharp confrontation with the folly of their life and realizing that there are bigger things, the kind of things that we should all think about: faith, hope, love, charity. But he did not, he wrote as an entertainer. He did not write books in order to sort of put people off. He wrote them in newspapers for people to follow week by week by week, which is why there are so many cliffhangers and mysteries and, you know, exploding. There's somebody who sets fire to, you know, who's what's the word called, spontaneous combustion, that's right, sorry. You know, he has a somebody who just is left, all you see is their slippers,
like, you know, a Spinal Tap drummer gone.
Precisely. So he was, yeah, we may not take that analogy too far, I suppose. I was going to say he was the Spinal Tap of his day, and that's not quite right.
No, because
what
I
am saying is he was an entertainer.
Absolutely. Yes, exactly. He was not written to be studied. It was written for fun, wasn't it?
No, so, quite so. Quite.
Well, so now we're coming to the end of the year. So just beyond the Christmas market, so doing the TLS podcast as you do, and in your journalism work, you'll have to tell us what have been your standout books of the year. Obviously, we know about the Booker Prize, but give us your own personal take on what's been the cream of the crop.
Well, it's been a really interesting year. I very much enjoyed a biography of the great writer Muriel Spark called Electric Spark. I immensely enjoyed actually a book that appeared on the Booker Prize shortlist, The Loneliness of Sonia and Sonny, which I will admit is a large book, but that will keep you through if you are like me going to the greenhouse in need of some escape. I think it's been a very strong year in fiction, but also there have been some brilliant autobiographies, and I know that people like to, you know, like to give them, and mm-hmm. also like to curl up with them, and I think, I suppose, cream of the crop there would be Kathy Burke's biography, A Mind of My Own, and that I found immensely enjoyable.
Yes, it's funny, isn't it? Biographies really do sell like hotcakes at this time of year in big hardbacks. So, yes, Kathy Burke. What other ones are out there in the non-fiction area?
I would say look at Tina Knowles's Matriarch, which is the story of what it's like to be the mother of Beyoncé and Solange Knowles. And also, if you're keen on that kind of acting, showbiz kind of tell-all, Anthony Hopkins' book, We Did OK, Kid, is wonderful. So if you want to know the story behind the Hannibal Lecter actor, there you have it.
Yes, and am I right to think that's a bit of a warts and all one? He's quite open and honest, isn't he?
Absolutely, he is. I mean, he's had various sort of issues in his life and struggles, and very much so. He you know, it's very, very Thoughtful is a word I've seen attached to it, and I would agree it's a very thoughtful book. And also I really, really enjoyed Arundhati Roy's memoir, Mother Mary, Come to Me, and Young Chang, who people will may be great readers of Wild Swans, which came out many years ago. But Young Chang has written another installment of her tale of her life during China's turbulent history.
Yes, these all sound brilliant. And another actor, if I'm right, I've seen in the shops with a memoir out is the great Tim Curry, a national treasure. Has that one sort of crossed your path and his stories? Because he's not been well. So it's interesting to see him sort of in the public through the books, at least.
Yes, this is Vagabond, isn't it? This is Rocky Horror Picture Show. Now, I will tell you, I don't know if many of your listeners, I imagine they are keen audiobook listeners, as I am, and I listened to his biography, which he reads himself in extraordinarily fruity tones. He does not disappoint. He goes the full Tim Curry on reading it. So if you are interested in that and you are an audiobook consumer, as so many people are, I would suggest that would be one way to experience it.
OK, fantastic. And well, now let's look ahead, because you say 2025 has been a strong year. The thing about the book market, as I know to my, you could say a pleasure and indeed cost, is that the book market looks way ahead, doesn't it? So you probably know already what's coming out in 2026. What should we be particularly excited about for the new year?
I do. I mean, that you're right. The proof copies, the advanced copies of books are flooding onto my desk and actually have been since about September. I'm going to read a couple of them over Christmas, and I have Maggie O'Farrell's new book. Now, obviously, with Hamnet just being released into the cinema, that's got a particular sort of interest at the minute. I mean, people really enjoy Maggie O'Farrell's novels, and this is a story set in Ireland in the 18th century, 18th, 19th century, and it's the west of Ireland, and it's essentially the mapping of Ireland. It's called Land. So that will be coming out relatively early in the new year, and also a novel by the great novelist Frances Spofford, who again I'm sure many of your listeners will have enjoyed Golden Hill, and he has a new book called Nonesuch, which is a brilliant title, I think, for a novel, and I can't tell you what it's about because it is my Christmas treat, so much so that I have forbidden myself even to read the blurb.
Oh, wow. Oh, OK. Well, you'll have to come back in the new year.
I will tell you all about it. But I kind of, you know that way. Yes. You know you're going to like it. You know that this writer really speaks to you and you're going to enjoy it. So I'm really, that's why I've kept it aside.
Isn't that, yeah, that's wonderful, isn't it? It's a bit like following a band, isn't it? Where when someone brings out that next book and you think, I trust them implicitly. I don't want to know anything. I just want to curl up and let the story roll.
It's the voice, isn't it?
Yes.
You know that voice and you know it. And that's the great thing that books can do. You will have that author's voice in your head accompanying you.
Yes, I always have that with Robert Harris. Can't get enough of him.
New book from him next year, I believe, as well.
Oh, fantastic.
I cannot quite remember. I think it's one of the Roman ones.
Oh, I think that's right. As he's going back to ancient Rome. Oh, exciting. Yeah.
He's fantastically versatile, isn't he?
He really is. I should say, we've had a message from Steve saying, I have read A Christmas Carol every year in December for the last 20 years. It's a wonderful book with warming messages and everyone should try it.
Steve, I salute you, Steve.
So just finally, would you say if you are curling up, it's because there are thousands upon thousands of books keep coming out, but the classics are always there. Should people sort of try one new book, one old one? What's your view on that?
Well, that's the kind of thing that I always do, you know, whether I'm packing for a holiday or planning just any time when I might have some time off, then I like to switch. And also that business of long and short, you know, read some short stories if you don't feel you've got a huge amount of time to devote to, you know, really following a long narrative through. Read a wonderful short story. You know, Sylvia Townsend Warner, for example. I mean, there are many, many brilliant short story writers available to you. Get one of the anthologies or indeed dip into something old, just pick something off the shelf, and you'll find once you get into it, Wilkie Collins would be my favourite for that kind of thing,
I think,
because so much fun and so modern. You know, a lot of writers, it's like we always say about people in the past, you know, they weren't just sort of walking around in costumes being sort of old-fashioned on purpose.
No, we must give them the credit that they are due.
Do you know what I mean? They were modern people to themselves.
Exactly. Well, look, thank you so much for a panoply of recommendations. That's Alex Clark, literary journalist and host of the TLS podcast. Coming up, why going to the cinema is another perfect festive activity. It's 3:46 and this is John Harvey.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6 with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are. I am so looking forward to Christmas. I absolutely love everything about it. Decorating the tree, wrapping the presents. For us, it's always been a big family get-together. Me, Mike, the kids, my sister Julie, and all her family too. We all go back home to Mum and Dad's house. It's a bit of a squeeze these days, but Mum and Dad are both in their 80s now, and it's really important that we all go where we've always gone for Christmas. It just wouldn't be the same any other way. Thankfully, this year we have Carol, Mum and Dad's lovely care professional from Home Instead. Home Instead are amazing. I honestly don't know what we'd do without them. Carol comes and visits in the week when we're all busy at work and makes sure that Mum and Dad have everything they need. Obviously, this year, we've all offered to help with preparing the Christmas dinner, but Mum absolutely insists that she's got it all under control. Which means Carol has.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
This is Times Radio.
It's 3:48 and this is John Harvey. Now, if you find yourself at a bit of a loose end during the Betwixtmas period or the Merineum or whatever you call it, perhaps you just fancy some quiet time away from the family, why not consider taking yourself off to the cinema? I love movies and I caught up with cinema buff and presenter Clara Amfo, and she told me her film recommendations and why she loves going alone.
I love going to the cinema, always have, always will. Don't get me wrong, it's lovely to be able to stream things from the comfort of your own home, and I do it too, and it's lovely to sort of, you know, be aware of like the Christmas telly schedule and what films are going to be on. But there is something really special about, yeah, getting up and going to the cinema, whether it's Christmas Day, Boxing Day, and the festive period, and like getting into like a new release or a rerun that might be on at your local, because I think it just feels good. And I think it's community building, but also it's just a lovely thing to do like for yourself. Like, I am a big advocate, and don't get me wrong, I'm a social person, but I also love my own company, and I'm a big advocate of going to the cinema alone. I think it's I like the fact that there's not much pressure really, and you don't have to sort of, you know, because I'm sure we've all got that friend or family member who you could literally have them right next to you. You could be watching the same thing and they'll still say to you, so what's going on? Who's that person? But why do they do that? Just watch it. We're here.
Yes, let me pick you up on that, because I'm like you. I do like going to the cinema on my own. And having a four-year-old, I haven't done it for a long time, so I'm feeling very wistful. Okay. But I just wonder whether, yes, it gets you out of yourself and out of your normal existence, because these days, you know, the tyranny of choice means we can watch anything we want, whether it's Christmas Day or any day. And so that feeling of sort of festive fun maybe is diluted from what it used to be. So getting out there, going to a picture house, whether it's a great big multiplex or a little independent one, it's a very different experience. So, yeah, do you think this is something which should be talked about more as something we can do? It doesn't matter whether you're a group or not. And also, in that sense, this year in particular, what could we go out and see?
I mean, yeah, oh my God, there's so many. I mean, I guess during the festive period, because I kind of count that till the start of January, really, because because also I also understand that some people, when it's like Christmas Day, Boxing Day, and because literally the cinemas are closed on Christmas Day, but like Boxing Day, most cinemas will reopen again. Like you get so many great releases on Boxing Day. But I kind of count this period up until, I'd say like till the end of January, really, because everyone's still a little bit like, you know, in that haze of wanting to do like slow, cozy things. And the cinema's a great thing to do. So I would recommend Eternity. It's that A24 movie and it's like, it's really charming. It's got like Elizabeth Olsen in it, Miles Teller and Callum Turner. That it's a really like sweet, like really like alternative rom-com, I would say.
Okay.
I think that's really fun. Marty Supreme, the new Timothy Chalamet movie. I think that comes out on Boxing Day. I'll definitely be going to see that. Because he's done a great job with the press run. So I really, really want to see that. And I would say, you know what? Respect to the Avatar crew, because James Cameron is so ambitious with his vision for this world and these films. And he really has had this audience in the palm of his hands for almost two decades now with the slow release and making of these films. And so, you know, yeah, Fire and Ash, like, why not?
Well, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Avatar, because I saw the first one in the cinema. I think a lot of people did. And I mean, wasn't it at the time the biggest grossing movie of all time? I mean, Cameron has a habit of doing that.
He loves it.
Yeah. But it was spectacle. I mean, arguably even more than Marvel movies, even more than Lord of the Rings. You know, Cameron does spectacle like no other. So I guess if you were to go to the cinema to see something you really couldn't do justice to on the small screen, maybe, you know, Avatar is offering you something that you can't get with anything else. Is that right?
Well, this is it. And also, you know, when you think about these filmmakers, yes, they want you to enjoy their films at your leisure, I'm sure. But primarily, most of the filmmakers that I've been able to interview, particularly this year, like, you know, I interviewed Ryan Coogler this year. I hosted the premiere of Sinners. And, you know, and he said, I want you to watch this on the biggest screen possible. And I'm sure James Cameron is no different, and many other filmmakers, because, you know, seeing something at the cinema, it's an experience, you know, like it's part of the ritual. You know, you go, you get your snacks, you get your drink, you sit down, you get comfy, and you know you're going to be immersed into another world. You can just forget anything that's going on in your life and just be in this experience in a dark room full of strangers. Like I think it's really cool. And I think it can be healing for a lot of people as well, particularly people who are feeling isolated this Christmas, who are feeling lonely, but also people who are voluntarily wanting to be alone at Christmas just for no other reason. And that's just what they choose to do, because I just think there's so much pressure on having this like picture perfect festive experience. I just don't think that's a reality for most people, you know?
Yeah, and it's interesting you say that, because just you sort of getting that sense of a cinema, because I haven't been for a while, you're making me feel very excited for it. Because it's a darkened room, but it's also paradoxically escapism, isn't it? Because, I mean, I remember an ex-girlfriend of mine once used to say, oh, I don't want to go to the cinema. Why would I want to spend 3 hours in a dark room? And with you, you wear a music hat and a movie hat in your professional career. Of course, music is, there is such an obvious communal aspect to going to see live music. Mm. That cinema has something special in its intimacy, doesn't it? There's something peculiar and special about movies outside in that cinema space, isn't there?
Well, yeah, because very much like going to a gig, everyone, or even going to like a gallery, going to see an exhibition, like everybody has come here for a common goal, to enjoy somebody else's art, really, somebody else's vision, somebody else who wants to give you, you know, the gift of escapism, really, because that for me anyway, that's what it's all about. And I think, you know, there's been times I've gone to the cinema alone and there's been other people in there solo, and sometimes you might give each other like, you know, the nod or like a little smile, like, okay, cool, you're doing this too. And then at the end of it, you might even exchange a word with the person. And I think that's a really cool thing, because, you know, in this life we never truly know 100% what's going on with people. And I think, you know, you don't know that the day that you've gone to cinema to see what, like, let's just say, like, for example, I saw Sinners this year, I think I saw it five times. I'd see it once before I hosted the premiere. I stayed again to watch it after the premiere. And then I went and saw it two more times with mates, and then one more time by myself. And each time was a different experience. But the time I went by myself, I remember having a chat with somebody coming out of the lobby being like, oh my gosh, like, good, right? Yeah, oh my God, I loved it. Da, 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 da. And went on with my business. And I don't know who that person is. Mm. And I would probably likely never see them again. But it, what a lovely thing to have a conversation with a stranger around a shared joy of something. And yes. I think, you know, depending on where you live in the UK, and I hate to add to any negative stigma attached to being a Londoner, because Londoners are very friendly, but also at the same time, in a busy metropolitan city, people can be quite self-absorbed and wrapped up in their own stuff, and can often be, you know, hesitant to make conversations with strangers. And I think it's just I think going to cinema alone is quite a good community builder.
Yes, as well. Yeah. I think you're right. That word community, you don't immediately think that. But I remember once when I went to see the Muppets movie, like in the mid-noughties, was it? And I've never been in a room with more people laughing together, complete strangers, just having such a wonderful collective experience. And it's a bit like, you know, if you go and watch sport over Christmas or something, you're surrounded by people you don't know, but you're all having a shared experience. But with a movie, you're all on the same team. So there's something really, exactly. There's something really joyous about that. Now, just finally, Clara, I've got to ask you this, because of course you are our film buff. What are your favourite festive movies, new or old? If you were to recommend something for us to watch over the festive period, what should it be?
Now, before I ask this question, are you talking about specifically Christmas themed movies or films that I like to enjoy at Christmas? Because you know how there's an eternal question, is Die Hard actually a Christmas movie? Or is it just a film you watch at Christmas? What are your stipulations for this question?
I will allow you the parameters. In my opinion, Die Hard is both allowed and a masterpiece.
Right. Okay. So my favourite films to watch at Christmas / festive movies are Sister Act 2. I think it's just absolutely joyous.
Back in the habit.
Exactly. And also, you know, it is a Christmas movie because she's a nun. Non-church business.
Lovely.
So we can make the connection there. Do you know what? It's cliche, but I do love Actually, as problematic as it is with a 2025 lens. And I can say that with chest. And it's a conversation that I know Richard Curtis and Emma Freud welcome wholeheartedly, and their daughter Scarlett. Like, I'm not saying anything out of pocket. Like, every year you see the same discourse, and it cracks me up because it's true. with every year I watch that film, I'm like, oh my God, that was actually quite messed up, but I still love it, and I will still watch it, and I will still, you know, go at Alan Rickman's character for what he does to poor Emma Thompson, and I will still cry at her scene, and you know, and I was still swoon at, you know, Martina McCutcheon and Hugh Grant as the Prime Minister and Natalie, and it's lovely. So I say, yeah, Sister Act 2, Love Actually. A third, it's underrated. It's a gorgeous film called Untamed Heart. It's set at Christmas, and it's got Marissa Tomei in it, and it's so lovely, and it's really beautiful film, and it'll make you cry. Untamed Heart. Yeah.
Lovely. Oh, Untamed Heart, and you've also mentioned Eternity at the cinema.
Yes, I love Eternity. It's really cleverly done. Like, it's fab. I think it's really underrated, actually.
Perfect. And if you want to look at it for good or ill, Love Actually is on TV over the festive season, so you can see whether it's fallen foul of any more politically correct controversies.
Well, thanks so much to Clara Amfo for her festive cinema choices and bigging us up to go to the cinema as well. That's it from me today. I'll be back tomorrow from 1, where we'll be asking whether Victorians made or ruined Christmas, plus the best board games to play with your family. Thanks to the production team today, Rosie, Lizzie, Eve and Joseph, and Robin Warren pushing the buttons. Up now, John Pienaar with Drive.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, John. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar with Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. Chris Rea, the singer-songwriter behind Driving Home for Christmas, has died at the age of 74. And ministers could use tariffs to stop British farmers being undercut by foreign imports after the government's animal welfare reforms. And coming up, a festive feast of a programme. I'm going to be talking to Westminster Watchers about Wes Streeting and what's he up to as he backs, well, the idea of getting closer to joining the customs union, it seems, despite the PM not going there. And why do kids only sing in choirs at Christmas? I'll be talking to a choir master.
Lancaster about a campaign to get more people singing year round.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. The singer-songwriter Chris Rea, who's known for his festive hit Driving Home for Christmas, has died at the age of 74. In a statement, his family says he'd been in hospital following a short illness. Driving Home for Christmas was released in 1986 and features in this year's M&S Food Christmas advert. Speaking to Times Radio, the music journalist Matt Charlton said the track was a stroke of genius.
This is quite a hopeful song, and it really works on the radio at Christmas, as you'll mostly find yourself stuck in your car going somewhere. So it was a bit of a masterstroke on his part to write such a song.
Ministers could use tariffs to stop British farmers being undercut by foreign imports after the government's animal welfare reforms. Rural campaigners have warned that plans to ban cages for chickens and pigs could threaten British farming if not matched by higher welfare standards for imported meat. It's feared countries with lower standards could offer cheaper produce. The Times' countryside correspondent Will Humphreys has called the farmers' response unprecedented.
Farmers don't really unite about anything. They all, you know, keep to their own farm, keep an eye on the neighbour and, you know, try and outcompete them normally. They can't really agree on many things. It is pretty incredible what Labour have done in uniting, you know, almost every farmer I've spoken to or known is completely against the tax changes and is completely against what they're doing in terms of the environmental schemes.
Tony Blair's former Europe minister has told Times Radio Britain rejoining a customs union with the EU is an idea worth exploring. It comes as the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has openly defied Sir Keir Starmer by backing the move, despite the Prime Minister ruling it out. Polling suggests strong support for the idea among Labour voters, fueling speculation about the Health Secretary's leadership ambitions. Speaking to Times Radio, Dennis McShane said Sir Keir Starmer needs to be bold.
It's not a magic solution. Nonetheless, the hit to our economy is clear. So many firms have just not able to have to shut down because they can't trade as once they did. And all the promised jobs and investment from Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage have not arrived, are not going to arrive. So what do? Just become poorer, sort of sadder, decay gently into irrelevance?
Two men have been jailed for raping a teenager in Rotherham more than two decades ago. 44-year-old Kesser Ejeb received an 8.5-year sentence, while Mohammed Mahmoud, who's 43, will serve 7 years. The reporter Fraser Maud's at Sheffield Crown Court, where a victim's statement was read out.
She spoke of how, for years, I didn't know I was being abused because it was happening to so many other girls around me. She said she spent years in denial, blaming herself, blaming her family. She spoke of her fear, embarrassment, shame and heartache as a result.
And the UK's competition watchdog warns drivers could be paying over the odds at the petrol pumps. It's found retailers' profit margins remain persistently high despite a fall in wholesale costs. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, John Pienaar, at Drive, on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Now, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. I'm not saying Keir Starmer's paranoid, though the recent briefing against his cabinet colleague, the Health Secretary Wes Streeting, tells you there's a lot of paranoia in Downing Street. But either way, look at Streeting's weekend comments about the need to push harder for a closer relationship with the European Union and the value of the EU single market, and you will see plenty of fuel for paranoia in number 10. Look harder, and you can just make out the outline of a reason for Keir Starmer to believe they are out to get him. And when I say they, I mean Wes Streeting. I'll be weighing up the strength of the threat to the Prime Minister in a moment. And a bit later, what has President Trump got to be nervous about? I'll get you right up to date with the release of the massively redacted Epstein files with stacks of photographs of the multimillionaire paedophile with his rich, powerful and famous friends. And these, of course, included Donald Trump. It makes you wonder what's been blacked out. And why, doesn't it? Send me a text. Tell me what you think. 87222. Start with the word Times. Retweet to @TimesRadio. First, though, Wes Streeting has suggested Britain maybe would get closer to the customs union on an ideal relationship, which put him rather at odds with what Keir Starmer said so far. The PM has ruled out a change, warning it would undo trade deals with the US and India and so on. But a new poll for The Times does show 8 in 10 Labour voters back Streeting's a position of wanting to get closer, raises questions about the party's direction ahead of the next election, and in that way, questions about the leadership. Ollie Wright is the policy editor of The Times. Hello to you, Ollie.
Hello.
Hi, we're going to be joined also by Kevin Schofield, political editor of Half Post, who's also here now, I'm told. Hi to you, Kevin.
Hi there, John.
Hi, good to have you here too, Kevin. I want to ask you first, both, if I can. So when you look at Wes Streeting's comments about the need to get closer to the EU, Oliver, is he staying with the official line, or is he signalling that he wants Labour to go further? Is he subtly signalling he'd quite like to lead Labour in that direction? Or, as I suspect, all of the above?
He is certainly signalling that he has a different view on this than Keir Starmer. I mean, I think, you know, the point of this, you need to look at the chronology of it. First off, you have David Lammy, where he refused to say whether or not he would back the UK going into a customs union, after which Keir Starmer stood up not once but twice in Parliament and said, I don't favour it. And then this weekend you've got Wes Streeting coming out and saying, actually, I think it would be rather a good idea. He is clearly trying to differentiate his position from that of the Prime Minister, and I think we can all speculate on why he's doing that.
And why don't we just do that, Kevin? What are your thoughts on this? What is Wes thinking?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with Ollie there. I think it's not as much significant as what he said, but the fact that he said it, you know, the fact that he feels emboldened enough to come out and clearly set out a different vision for the UK's relationship with the EU from the Prime Minister. It's only 3-4 weeks ago that we had that briefing that from Number 10 sources that Wes Streeting was plotting to be a leader. That met with a very robust response from Wes Streeting. So there's no question he's not going away. He's not deciding to keep his head down. I think he knows that one way or another, there's a challenge coming to Keir Starmer in the new year, and he wants to be there in the mix.
Yeah, I mean, Oliver, I mean, among Labour MPs, among Labour Party members, among Labour Party activists, and in the public at large, there is a majority view that getting close to Europe, closer to Europe, would be a good thing. And more explicitly, towards the customs union and the single market and membership itself. When you